Hello and welcome everyone to the Weekly Pulse Podcast. My name is Jeff Snyder. I'm the founder and CEO of the Morning Pulse and your host for the next 60 plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to the markets, technology, personal finance, and so much more. We've got another great show for you. Our special guest this week, Zachary Tracer. He is the healthcare editor for Business Insider. So sit back, relax. We've got another great show and get ready for this edition of the Weekly Pulse. We're going to kick things off as we always do with a look at the latest social media trends. And joining me on the line is Mr. Devin Banerjee. He's a senior finance editor with the social media platform LinkedIn. Hi, Devin. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well. How was your week? Did you travel this week or were you based at home?
Fortunately, did not travel this week. No more traveling for the year, at least work travel. So good productive week in San Francisco, and I'm looking forward to the holidays.
I think we all are. It's been a tough but productive year, as you like to say, and we appreciate you coming on the show. So what are some of the latest trends and things that you're following as a senior finance editor at LinkedIn?
Yeah, absolutely. Even though we're approaching the holidays, a lot of people are still having some great conversations on social media. A couple of news items I wanted to start with that people are talking about. The first is, and I think objectively we can say good news, the Department of Education here in the U.S. has decided to cancel $150 million in student debt for students who were attending some of these for-profit colleges that closed. That closed actually while the students were enrolled there. Mm. So this was an Obama era rule, the borrower defense to repayment rule that actually the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, sought to block, but a federal judge ordered implementation of this rule. So about 15,000 borrowers will see their student debt wiped away. So I think objectively good news, but definitely goes to a point that we've talked about a lot this year, which is just the crushing magnitude of student debt here in the U.S. And so some good news on that front. Another piece of news that a lot of people are talking about is the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, which this organization reports monthly. It's actually declined for a third straight month, so optimism among small business owners and operators. So some of the factors we're seeing behind this, tight labor market, definitely the predominant factor. It's very difficult for small businesses, they're saying, to recruit qualified workers. The proportion of small businesses that are actually considering raising wages has reached a 30-year high, according to the NFIB, because of some of these issues. Another issue these small businesses are facing is inventory buildups and just the general anxiety around potential slowing of economic growth and the potential for sales to be stunted because of it. So definitely something to keep an eye on, which is optimism among small businesses. Sometimes that's a leading indicator, maybe.
Yeah, well, we need to. I think small businesses obviously are the lifeblood of the American economy. I've said that before, and I'm not the first. We need them to. We need new businesses to be created, and we need small businesses to employ people. And we want these folks to be optimistic, so that either they'll continue offering services and products, or do hiring. So I think that's a big, important metric, I guess, to measure the economy.
Yeah, definitely. And we've talked about this tight labor market for the past couple of months. Just another manifestation of it that we're seeing. This was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week that started a ton of conversation, which is that some of these modern day perks that once kind of dazzled new employees and help companies motivate their existing workforce, they're starting to be less effective. And so we're seeing, workers who have more choice in where they apply for jobs and where they take jobs, they want more than just the perks, the surface level perks. So we're seeing that they want meaning and impact in their jobs, in their roles. They want their leadership and their companies to stand for something, to stand for value. So we talked about that a couple of months ago with the controversial Nike ad that actually was extremely successful for Nike. And they want their companies and their managers to spend more resources on career advancement. So people want to see a clear career path to a better job. So a long way of saying that some of those surface level perks, like you know, free food or some of those benefits are becoming less important because employees have more choice and where they want to work.
Yeah, well, certainly eating too much can be a problem. You know, when I was kind of coming up in the ranks, there would be employee discounts at the cafeteria. Some organizations have cleaners that are on site to make it easier for employees to do business and come to work. Some companies, some of the tech companies had like childcare facilities.
Right.
I wonder, Devin, how much the employer match, so many 401k retirement plans have what's called an employer match. And I'm wondering if that is a perk that is driving people. I don't know if you have a sense of that, but is that type of perk still driving people to stay with companies or seek other employment?
Well, I do hope it is. And actually, I want to turn the question on you, Jeff. I wonder if we have some data or just some knowledge that more employers have come to offer that. So maybe it's just become more of like a table stakes situation. Do you know if that's the case here in the U.S.?
Well, I would say that, it's interesting you bring that up because the plan sponsor Council of America, PFCA, just released some statistics. And I don't have them handy, but I know that people have written about them. But if you remember back in 2008, many companies ended their company match because they didn't want to pay that out of company dollars when they were suffering. Many of them have put them back into place. I believe, excuse me if I'm misquote, but I think the most common employer match contribution is 50% of the first 6% of contributions. Now, when you take into account what people are, that means that you have to contribute 6% in order to get 3%. So, that's a total of 9% contribution. Whether or not your company gives a prop sharing is a whole different story. But as you and I have talked about, and we talk about on the show constantly, you really need double-digit savings. So, I think that the match is important in terms of incentivizing people to contribute to the plan. People should take full advantage of that. I'm not sure why people don't, other than maybe they don't have the dollars to contribute. But my sense is that more companies continue to offer the match because, especially in the higher tech world, that's something that can be seen as a benefit to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, as we've talked about in the past, I think just continual education around this topic, which is basically a lot of the work that you do. But yeah, I think a lot of people just haven't been educated by anyone, by a parent or a person not in school. In school, you don't learn about this kind of stuff, really. And so I think educational outlets and the media has a role to play in this.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a lot. It's funny that you are interesting. You kind of led with a story about Betsy DeVos, but we need to do in addition to some of these other things, student loan debt and getting people, our workforce educated for the new millennium and the future decades with technology and artificial intelligence. We do need to get back to basics and get in the trenches in terms of learning about budgeting. And, I'm very hopeful that people like Secretary DeVos and other people are going to start doing that in terms of having more curriculum there, because we need that. Without budgeting curriculum, without financial literacy, you have no way to make your way through the world. So I would think that should be
absolutely
a priority. Anyway, as I digress, I'm going to step off my soapbox and let you finish.
Last item I wanted to talk about, which actually sparked a ton of conversation, which is a study from the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, which says that being friends with your boss can actually cause a lot of problems in the workplace. So this study found that to avoid the perception of favoritism, a lot of managers are more likely to deny their coworker friends bonuses and other perks, even if they deserve such awards. Mm-hmm. So something to keep in mind in the workplace. Hopefully does not apply to everyone, but this study from this reputable publication found that bosses are more likely to exhibit bias against their friends if some of these decisions about promotions and bonuses and stuff are made public in the workplace. And so, definitely something to keep in mind.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense in a way. I mean, you have like, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but favoritism, nepotism, that kind of thing can definitely, begin to take shape, I think, and people are kind of nervous about that, I would imagine. But if someone deserves an award based on the merits, maybe they should get one, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess some managers are just worried about the backlash. Like, oh, well, isn't that just friends? You know, isn't that just friend Josh or Mary who's getting the promotion? But
yes, it's my friend Devin who deserves the promotion.
There you go.
Let me say that.
I don't have a problem with that.
I'm just kidding. Well, Devin, always a pleasure. Thanks for so much for, you know, one, tracking the trends, and then spending a few minutes with us, more than a few minutes with us, updating our audience of what you guys are seeing. You guys are obviously one of the largest social networks in the world, so you have a lot of weight in terms of what people are talking about. So get some rest this weekend and get ready for the holidays. Maybe go out, take your wife shopping, whatever, and enjoy yourself, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Take care.
Bye. Well, welcome back, everyone, and we're going to shift gears a little bit, or a lot, I should say. Now we're going to talk a little tech, and joining me now on the line is the Motley Fool tech reporter, Ms. Natalie Walters. Hi, Natalie. How are you?
Hi, doing good. Glad to be back, and looking forward to Christmas.
Absolutely, but before we get to Christmas, obviously a lot of tech news, a lot of things going on with our friends at Amazon and Apple. So what's top of mind for you and the team at The Motley Fool?
Yeah, so something interesting I've been looking at this week is Apple and different companies getting more into healthcare. Mm. There was a report out this week that showed Apple has hired between 40 and 50 doctors in the past few years. And it's been a little bit secretive about these healthcare plans, and you know, CNBC was saying, you know, some of these doctors haven't updated their LinkedIn and they're kind of keeping it on the down low, but these doctors are kind of dispersed throughout Apple and helping them with different projects. And you know, it's been a big topic in recent years about Apple wanting to get into healthcare and sort of capture that market more, but you know, it takes a long time to develop those technologies and to make sure they're going to be safe and that they're good enough that doctors will approve of them and recommend them to their patients. And I think it would be great if we could start seeing some of those tools and technologies come out in the next year or so, so people can start to see what they've been working on. And, you know, Apple's definitely not the only one. You know, Amazon's also been working on different things. And just this week, Amazon said that it's going to team up with a blood pressure company, and they're going to work on integrating Alexa into the blood pressure monitor. So Alexa can set reminders for people, you know, remind people to do certain things, you know, just any way that these companies can use their own technology to help people with their own health.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry for interrupting. I was going to say, you may be, you know, Apple has got to be one of the leaders in the wearable market, I would imagine, with their iWatch, Apple Watch, and they just improved it recently now. And I have been seeing where you can do like an electrocardiogram using, you know, hooking things up to your Apple iPhone or your, I don't know if it's an EKG, but it was something along those lines. I mean, it can already read the pulse. So it makes sense when you look at the iOS system that they use on the iPhone. There's, you know, tracks your steps. So it makes sense that they would use some of that data in order to try to improve health results for people, right? I mean, it seems to make sense.
Right.
To me.
Yeah, it's such a huge market for people. And like as iPhone sales slow and, you know, they need other sources of revenue. And if they could really lock into healthcare, that could be huge for Apple. And obviously, it also create goodwill for the company if it can help people, you know, even do things like heal from certain injuries or, you know, help them, you know, I guess because I'm not a doctor, I don't want to say too much and claim I know what technology can do, but I think people would be surprised at, how much technology can do when it's integrated with the right products.
Yeah, absolutely. I
It'd be
think,
cool.
and then, you mentioned Amazon. Amazon trying to get into the healthcare market, in terms of offering prescription drugs. There's been a lot of mergers going on between, CVS and others. So, clearly a lot of movement, and it's certainly in a marketplace that needs innovation.
Yeah, definitely. I know I check my steps every day, and it's helped me. Do you track your steps? I know people say to try to get 10,000 a day.
I actually do track my steps a little bit. So I was using an Apple Watch for, as we digress a little bit, I guess I was using a Apple Watch a little bit, and just to track the calories that I burn, because I do track what I eat. So I've been really regimented in terms of doing fitness. I work out 7 days a week, and I was using it to
Wow.
track my fitness, the calories. But I did find that the Apple Watch wasn't as good as track. Like I row every day on a rowing machine, and I found that it
Right.
didn't track the calories that I burned well because it was using the motion of my arms, which don't necessarily
Oh, okay.
move like you're running. So, but
Right.
I appreciate the technology. And look, I think it's important to be not only proactive in terms of your financial health, but if you're not healthy. If you're not healthy, you're
Yeah.
not going to live to the ripe old age. And now that I just got married, I want to be there with my wife and my cats and my
Yeah.
family. And
Right.
I want to be doing this show for a long time.
I'm right there with you.
So what else is going on? So let's shift gears to healthcare. What else has
Yeah.
been top of mind for you and the folks at Motley Fool?
Yeah, so one other thing that happened this week I wanted to touch on was Congress questioned Google's Sundar, and they had a big kind of showdown in DC. And the kind of big takeaway from this hearing was that, a lot of the members of Congress just aren't up to date on technology, and they seemed really out of touch. And the famous question that came out of it was one of the congressmen asked Sundar about an iPhone, and he had to explain that's not made by Google, it's made by a different company named Apple.
Nice.
And so that, because that's such a silly sort of
Yeah.
nonsensical question, that of course made a lot of headlines. But that was just one question. But it just seems like they didn't quite understand technology like they should. And I think that's kind of been a theme this year. There's been some big things we keep talking about, such as privacy, and people aren't trusting tech companies like they used to. And now Congress is getting involved and is questioning a lot of tech companies and wondering if regulations should be heightened. And another common theme is that when they do have hearings, the congressmen seem out of touch. When they're questioning, Facebook's Zuckerberg or Sundar, and it's not a good look for them. And it's just 2018 has been such a transition year from, before we all just thought tech companies are great, and now we're all having to transition to look at them closer, and Congress is having to do the same thing too. And I think over the coming years, they're going to have to pay more attention to tech companies and become better versed in the language used to address them.
Yeah, well, obviously, Congress people, Congress men and women, and those in the Senate tend to be generalists. I mean, they may be doctors or attorneys or whatever, but they have a lot on their plates. I mean, they may be part of the Armed
Yeah.
Services Committee. They may be part of Ways and Means. I mean, I think to understand this stuff, you have to be ingrained in it, and cybersecurity is so important. I would expect that these folks would get an upgrade in terms of being briefed and what they need to be talking about. But you're right;
Yeah.
it sinks to the level of absurdity to be asking about an iOS device versus an Android device. Or I saw
Right.
some of the or heard some of the questioning. Getting back to the politics and prioritizing certain search results. I mean, at
Oh,
some
yeah.
point, we got to kind of cut through the clutter and get to the process of making good laws and regulation. But, I guess that's sometimes a little too easy in this current political strata that we're in.
Yeah, like you said, it's new for everybody, and it's new for Congress to have to pay this much attention to tech companies. So I think they'll hopefully get better at the questioning and, know which questions to ask as time goes on and more of these hearings happen.
Well, Natalie, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your due diligence and your hard work and effort in keeping the readers of Motley Fool up to date and sharing a couple minutes with us here on the podcast. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Thanks so much. Look forward to it.
Welcome back, everyone. And, you know, the markets have really been up and down. And joining me now to talk about the markets, we've got our fabulous threesome. We've got Mr. Oliver Rennick. He's the lead anchor with TD Ameritrade Network. We've got Kevin Kelly, principal with Delphi Digital, and the president of Money Alignment Academy, Mr. George Grombacher. Hey, guys, how are you?
Doing great.
What's going on, Jeff?
Well, it's always a pleasure talking with you all. And Oliver, I want to start with you. You had another great show this week in New York City. Well, that's just not my opinion. That's the audience's opinion, of course. and want to get your sense of, you know, this has been really an up and down market. My mother's nervous.
Sure.
I'm sure many of the American people are nervous about what they're seeing. And what's your takeaway from the week and what you covered on the network?
Yeah. Well, we, as mentioned, started off Monday. We had a pretty great show on the NASDAQ, talked with some CEOs, talked markets, talked some crypto. So we can follow up on that with our man from Delphi. But as far as equity markets go and sort of the traditional markets, as I call them, it's been pretty choppy. I mean, as we've been discussing here, there's kind of two big themes I've been following and guiding our coverage. And it began really in September with the correction that was happening in the high-growth tech and expensive companies. Many associate that with the FANG group, which is definitely a subset of it, but it just is a larger type of investing style that has been very winning over the past really 7 years throughout much of the bull market, but then kind of came under fire. Thing is, when that happens, it happens to good companies, and a lot of the companies are continuing to show really great numbers, but any sign of slowing of that growth, and investors are pretty quick to run. So that's sort of the first big theme, which is a correction in terms of prices for some of the best performing companies throughout the bull market. And when that happens, there's kind of no telling where it goes, because it's just a speculative trade that kind of slowly either winds down or ends or takes a breath, and you don't really know where it stops. Think Facebook, Netflix, stuff that's down like 30-40%. The other big theme that first showed up in the bond market was investors becoming more concerned about the U.S. economy. Very much the best house on the block. The U.S. dollar remains very strong. There's probably some stuff with tariffs going on in there too, but now there is a worry that things may not last for very long and that we won't be able to keep up the rate of growth. This recently started to show up in equity markets in a pretty clear way with industrials and material stocks, things that are supposed to do well when the economy does well. So as long as both those two things are under pressure, it makes a pretty tough case for equities. And there's a lot of headline stuff about the trade. There's a lot of headlines about politics and geopolitics and all that. But at the end of the day, the really sort of core fundamental for owning stocks, earnings growth and multiple appreciation are both sort of under pressure. And that's kind of the big picture look. So that's how I would generally characterize the stock market.
Great. Well, thanks, Oliver. And Kevin, what we really like about the TD Ameritrade Network and what Oliver and the team do is it's really educational and they kind of take out all that noise, so to speak. But what's your sense? You know, you're covering crypto at Delphi Digital Research, but you're also a former equity strategist. What do you take away from all this up and down, this whipsawing that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, putting on the equity strategy hat, for sure agree with what Oliver was saying. I think one of the key points he hit on that I'd like to reiterate is the concept of valuation multiples and the compression there. I think when you look at what the, you know, markets have been trading at, take the S&P 500 and that multiple, you know, got as high as 18 times forward earnings, you know, earlier this year, what you're really starting to see, to Oliver's point, is that any kind of concern about growth going forward, you're going to see that multiple compression because typically investors will pay a higher, you know, price to earnings ratio for some of these higher growth companies. So if that growth starts to stall, or at least there's signs that growth could be potentially stalling, this is what you would expect. You would expect multiples to compress. And if earnings are still remaining pretty strong, you'd likely see that multiple compression in the top of that ratio. So you'd like to see, you know, price compression. So I think that's kind of one of the underlying or underpinning stories here, to Oliver's point about, you know, the concerns about, you know, growth slowing. And I think as you get those concerns, you get later and later in this cycle, as we've talked about, you know, people are still looking at the crypto markets, shifting over to crypto. You're still looking at the crypto markets as a pretty risk on, you know, asset class. It's not necessarily these long-term implications. And these, we actually came out with a report this week you can find on our website where we kind of dive into what we think the long-term potential drivers of Bitcoin could be. And right now, you know, a lot of the arguments about it being a long-term store of value or potentially capturing some of the offshore bank account market or the investable gold market, it's really tough to make that argument right now because it is still a really volatile asset. And you can't have a store of value that depreciates or loses 80% of its value in a 12-month period. That simply is not a good store of value. So the longer-term implications, we think it has a lot of characteristics that could complement something like gold. But again, in the short term, or at least, you know, the intermediate term, it's difficult to see how, you know, that really Bitcoin can really take off while you still have a lot of kind of risk-off sentiment really starting to, you know, permeate throughout the markets.
Well, that's I want to come back to crypto. Thank you, Kevin, for the macro dovetailing into Oliver and starting our conversation, leading off with your report. George, I want to come to you because these guys are great. They're super smart and they know the markets really well. But you're out there, and you're super smart too, by the way. I just want to say that for the very smart. But
Thank you. But
you're also dealing with the average investor, and you're talking to, but not only employers, but you're also talking to people out there in your great home state of not home state, but your state of Arizona. What are the sentiments? What are people feeling? What are they talking about when you're out there?
Well, I can tell you it certainly still is volatility. And we had that news come out about Johnson & Johnson today, and who knows what that's really going to do long term. And that's a long time dividend aristocrat, and with companies like GE that have been struggling this year. So if it's the overall market or if it's sort of those bellwether American companies that are experiencing an enormous amount of volatility and who knows moving forward, that's certainly still the what I get a ton of questions about is the volatility piece. But what I can also tell you about is how you do one thing is really how you do everything. And reading about how Starbucks is going to start delivering coffee now. Well, I think that if you're in the habit of going through the drive-thru at Starbucks and now you're going to stop doing that and just having them bring it to your house, that we really don't need to be talking about the stock market. We need to be talking about your spending habits, and you need to knock that off. So
I don't know. It sounds kind of. I agree, but it kind of sounds lazy to me.
It's 100% lazy.
And I should say that I had lunch earlier, and I actually had it delivered too. So I'm a little bit of a hypocrite. Thanks.
We're talking about coffee.
I know, but it's just. Yeah, I agree. I make my own coffee, but let's kind of pivot back, Oliver, to what Kevin was talking about. Because you had a great show this week, and at your NASDAQ show, you had some crypto. You talked a lot crypto, and I think you made the point that you had one of the best crypto conversations you, besides talking to Kevin, in your life.
Of course.
So, what do you take away from the crypto market?
You know, it was a really fascinating show. We had some of the sort of leading voices that have been very strong proponents of this all the way down. And what I think is so useful and in the way it sort of showcased our value proposition, what we're doing here is it's entirely about usefulness. What we're trying to do for no matter what asset class we're covering on a daily basis is trying to find the best sort of logical explanation for what's happening in markets, any market, and trying to distill that in a way that is going to be, you know, useful to investors. So for the crypto market, there's so many unknowns that it becomes a pretty fun sort of thing to navigate from an analysis perspective. For me, it is, you know, never really been an interest of whether it goes up or down, but more kind of a examination of the underlying principles that are so fundamental to much of market analysis. And if what these, you know, what the bullish crowd says, if indeed comes true, then we're going to be rethinking a lot of those things. So it's important to really, I think, take in the scale of what we're discussing, regardless of the outcome of how all this crypto stuff ends up or what use case it finds. That means a lot of discussions on our program on Monday that were actually a lot less about price and more sort of about these big questions of how to logically sort of go through this, how to find economic principles and apply them in this market. We had Nolan Bowerly on from CoinDesk, who was very passionate about the cryptographic side, and we essentially had a almost philosophical discussion, if you will, about sort of technical purity versus utility. With Ari Paul, we had a discussion very much that was kind of a logical, spar, if you will, about how and why people would adopt this, and actually more specifically within the Bitcoin space, something very interesting economically and mathematically to do with how it's mined. And then we had a group of investors on to talk about sort of how to invest in this, whether or not you can do it really right now successfully, and what kind of products make sense. So it was a hugely informative session.
Well, great. Kevin, why don't you spend the next 30 minutes or 30 seconds, not 30 minutes. We don't. No one's going to listen for that long. The next 30 seconds, kind of wrapping it up. And which we take away from the report?
I would listen.
That's one. I would listen, but I'm just saying the audience is very fickle. They barely listen to me. Anyway, but I'm not.
No, I hear you. No, I hear you. In the interest of time. No, I mean, there are a lot of really good conversations, that Oliver had on Monday. And I think what he did do a good job of was, trying to drive at the heart of some of these questions where, a lot of what's the discussion in the crypto markets or just general markets that are the kind of the outside looking into crypto, a lot of these things don't necessarily get questioned, or sometimes they become almost kind of like consensus within the crypto space without, somebody really digging in and asking even some of the simple questions about why, what the use case is for this, or what, who would actually find value in this longer term. So, no, I really enjoyed a lot of the conversations Oliver had. I thought he was asking, some hard Thank questions, you. Some tough questions, and, not a whole lot of softballs there, Ollie.
Well, there's a lot of money at stake. At least there was 80% ago.
It's a mutual admiration society, guys. We're going to have to leave it there. George Grunbacher, Kevin Kelly, Oliver Rennick, have a great weekend, great Friday, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Later.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Yep. Bye. Welcome back, everyone. And, healthcare is such a big component of retirement. I think I've seen studies out there that estimate that healthcare in today's dollars for a couple retiring is around $250,000 to $300,000. That's a lot of money that you have to save in order to be able to pay for these healthcare expenses. So I want to check in with someone who really tracks what's going on in healthcare. Joining me now is the healthcare editor for the Business Insider, an online publication, Mr. Zachary Tracer. Hey, Zach, how are you, bud?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And as I kind of led up into your intro, healthcare is really important for people to understand and have money for, because, as I said in my opening remarks, I mean, it's a considerable amount of money for people who retire, and as you get older, the parts start to wear out and you've got to fix them. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of check in with you. You cover the healthcare marketplace for Business Insider. And so I wanted to see if you might be able to take myself and the listeners through the latest trends, what you're seeing at the Insider about healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think from a really broad perspective, 2017, 2 years ago, that was a year about the Affordable Care Act, year of healthcare politics. And we spent a lot of that year kind of embroiled in this, should this law be repealed and efforts to repeal it. And, that kind of petered out. Mm-hmm. And that really led to, 2018 and sort of into 2018, this year was really a year of sort of innovation and a year of companies kind of taking action to reshape the healthcare system. And I just want to highlight a few key deals and key developments, and then we can kind of dive into some of them. But, this is, CVS, the big pharmacy chain, acquiring the health insurer Aetna. That was a deal that was announced really late in 2017. But that's really, been a big story of 2018, is how that, integration is going to change healthcare. Similarly, the health insurer Cigna acquiring Express Scripts, which is a big pharmacy benefits company, a big provider of Medicare prescription drug benefits. That was announced also in 2018. And then we've also seen, Amazon make really big moves in healthcare, both by buying the company PillPack, which is an online pharmacy, and then also by, really announcing that they're teaming up with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan to do something in healthcare, really saying, we're dissatisfied with the way things are going in healthcare. And we're going to, team up with these other huge companies to change it and improve it.
Yeah. So it's a, yeah, I all your points are well taken. I think you're right. Certainly, the Affordable Care Act, it's kind of settled law, and we need this innovation. I mean, I was reading a study that said healthcare spending is still exceptionally high for Americans, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that. No matter what we do to try to lower these expenses, whether it's bringing in third parties or consolidation, it still remains high. I don't know if some of that is due to some of the chronic obesity that we have and some other health issues that people have developed, but is that your sense from your analysis that the spending still remains fairly high for most Americans?
So, healthcare spending in this country is sort of starting at a high level works out to about $10,000 per person per year. The other way to look at that is to say that's about 18% of the economy that we spend on healthcare. That's way more than other developed countries. So the other developed countries are down at around, 10%, 12%, something like that. We're up at 18%. So we definitely spend a lot more than other countries. Part of that has to do, with sort of chronic disease. Part of that has to do with the fact that we sort of pay higher prices and folks in healthcare here. There's more profit to be made. There's, higher incomes and things like that in healthcare. So really, the healthcare system in this country is totally different from that of any other country. And we end up with, some very high costs and not really, maybe slightly worse outcomes for all the money we're spending. So it's certainly an expensive system.
Absolutely. And going into 2019, the new year's just around the corner. Any thoughts? I know innovation and consolidation was kind of the theme for 2018 with some big deals that you mentioned. What should we look for potentially? I'm not asking to put you on the spot, but potentially, what are you thinking might happen in 2019? More consolidation, more innovation?
One big question will be, we've seen, essentially these big announcements. We've seen, we saw CVS acquire Aetna and Cigna and Express Scripts are joining up. What will these companies do? What will it look like when these companies are actually joined together? What kinds of things will they roll out? Will that be better for consumers or worse? Those are sort of the questions that we'll be following. And then on, the big companies front, what will Amazon do? I think is a big open question. What will they do in partnership with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan? The other thing that, we should talk about is the Trump administration's push on drug pricing. So the Trump administration has said, drug prices are really a pain point for consumers. Drug prices in this country are too high. They've started to roll out some actions to bring that down or to, help folks who can't afford their drugs. But I think there's probably more to come. And they've said that there's more to come next year. So that's, something that we should definitely be mindful of as well.
Absolutely. Well, Zach, I want to thank you so much for your insight. Very interesting. It's a very important topic, clearly, for all Americans, whether you're young or old, to be able to take care of oneself. And so hopefully we can continue these conversations in the future. But we appreciate your time and hope you have a great holiday season. And we'll talk to you very soon.
Yeah, you too. This was great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Zach. Take care. Bye-bye. Welcome back, and now it's time for our Millennial Money segment. Joining me now is the creator and founder of Millennial Money, Mr. Grant Sabatier. Hey, Grant, how are you, bud?
I'm good, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. I know you've had a busy, busy week with film crews and filming and book tour stuff. We appreciate you visiting us for a few minutes. Now's our Millennial Money segment. So what's top of mind for you and some of the millennial folks out there?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing on everyone's mind is, should I keep investing in the stock market right now? What should I do with my money that I'm making in my full-time job right now and over the next year? That's been the biggest question that I've gotten, definitely. And I think that a lot of my audience and just younger investors in general are, wondering about what's going to happen in the next year. But I think a lot of them have a much shorter term focus than I would typically recommend. So often investing is best thought of from a short-term investing strategy, money you're going to need in 5 years or less, and then long-term investing, 10 plus years. And so that's been the biggest question that I've been getting. Should we be investing in the stock market? Where should we be putting our money? Or should we be sitting on the side for a little while?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you a question. In your conversations with folks and as you're speaking nationally, internationally, student loan debt, I know you've talked about it before on our program and in other places. Is that still top of mind for many people of your generation, but also other generations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's no secret that student loan debt just keeps growing. I mean, the average millennial still has over $35,000 in student loan debt. So it's obviously a huge topic of concern. The biggest problem with it, though, is I personally believe that a lot of people use student loan debt as kind of an excuse not to save or not to invest. That's the biggest excuse I have. I can't do that because I have student loan debt, or, you know, I haven't paid off my student loan debt. But in reality, yes, student loan debt, acknowledge it, but don't use it as a, you know, as an excuse to not be saving, to not be investing. And I just hear far too many people using it as one. Or it's still amazing. So many people, I'd say a majority of people, actually think that, you know, they should wait to invest before that, you know, they should wait to invest until after they've paid off their student loan debt entirely, mm-hmm. which is still mind boggling to me. The fact that some of these myths are perpetuated.
Yeah.
And then thankfully, you know, younger people, because they're seeing so many others with student loan debt, they are starting to question things like the value of a 4-year college degree. And that's going to be really exciting because the next couple of years, trade schools, community colleges, you know, more and more people are getting wise to what's known as college hacking, which is how can you get the best education for the least amount of cost. And so that's a whole field right now that's actually growing, and people are putting together strategies to help younger people not have to you know, take on that burden.
Yeah. In one of our previous segments on a show a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with Devin Banerjee, who you know is the senior finance editor at LinkedIn, and we actually talked about some of the trends. We always talk about trends in his segment, and that was a huge trend. How do you get value out of your college education, and is it worth spending all that money to get a master's of business administration or a master's of science or just an undergraduate degree from a premier school? And I think obviously with student loan debt, you have to, you know, you have to balance getting the education. You want to find the best value, and it's not necessarily you can't just buy on brand, right? I mean, you've got to buy on what is going to be good for you. Is it a small college, a big college? Do they have the right curriculum? What's the alumni network, you know, success rates in terms of jobs? Is college even right for you? I mean, I would imagine that people younger than us, younger than you especially, are kind of contemplating all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. But thankfully, just like I think it's never been easier in history to make money, it's never been easier to build a highly monetizable skill set, you know, even for free in a lot of cases. And so that's the most exciting thing when I get an email from, you know, an 18-year-old who, you know, is already making 100K with a business that they started in high school, and they're deciding not to go to college at all, or at least forego going to college, you know, while they chase their entrepreneur dreams. And there's more and more stories like that. And that's super exciting. I think the ROI, particularly of master's degrees, is very, very low. Most master's degrees, unless you need it, of course, like a law degree to be a lawyer. But MBA programs outside of kind of the top 20 are going to have an increasingly hard time. I don't know if you know, but in a former life, I owned a company that marketed MBA programs. So I have a lot of expertise in that area as well.
Interesting. I don't know if – let me ask you about this, and I, you know, we didn't talk about this before you came on, but let me just get your reaction to this. So I read a news article yesterday that the investment company BlackRock, which is one of the largest investment companies, if not the largest in the world, is entering into some type of partnership with Microsoft in order to create retirement tools for investors. And I just wanted to get your thoughts about that. I think it's really interesting. I guess I bring it up because I think it's really interesting between the intersection of investment company and a technology company like Microsoft, which has basically formed the backbone of so much of the technology that we use today.
Absolutely. I mean, BlackRock is always kind of at the forefront of just investing tools, investing strategy. I know they've done a ton around AI building. So not surprised there at all. And, you know, really encouraged by some of that development that I see in the space. So I really believe that a vast majority of money decisions, you know, are a mathematical one in a lot of cases. And while it can't replace the emotional side, technology that I see is getting better and better at ultimately helping you to automate. And automate meaning go way beyond like even the idea of a robo investor, robo advisor, and actually automate your financial life. So there's a lot of really cool stuff happening there. And I'm encouraged by those partnerships because at the end of the day, what that means is it's going to make, you know, strong sort of financial tools and solid financial advice more accessible to people who, you know, for example, can't afford a financial advisor or don't know what they don't know. And so kind of the democratization and the spreading of financial literacy, I see that all wrapped into one.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you bring that up. In the last 30 seconds, I want to get your opinion on, you know, we've talked offline about auto enrollment, auto escalation. You just talked about the democratization of financial literacy. How do we get more people to understand financial literacy? Because we don't want a nation of drones. We don't want people just to set it and forget it. We want people, I would think, to be somewhat involved. I mean, not in the day-to-day trading of their accounts because we don't, not in a long-term world, you don't want to do that per se, but how do you balance that and find, you know, get people up and running in terms of financial literacy and learning about the basics of managing a bank account or their budget?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing is, you know, platforms like YouTube, platforms like, you know, there's so much free, amazing advice out there, encouraging trends that more and more states are mandating, you know, some form of personal finance education in the classroom. While it's not perfect by any means, it's a start. Yep. I think there's so much work to be done there, simply at the education level. Unfortunately, a lot of teachers of those classes are either not qualified to teach them or, you know, hard to get kids to pay attention to money, for example, when they don't have a lot at stake. But there's, you know, this is one of those big problems out there that a lot of people are working on and trying to solve. And I'm seeing more and more encouraging strategies that are starting to pop up. And the cool thing now is clearly the power shift, the dynamic has shifted from the finance company to the consumer, simply because now there is so much information available. There are so many amazing tools. I don't know if you saw, but Robinhood just, just created a new sort of hybrid savings checking account that gets 3%. You know, that's something that so many people use Robinhood, even though I'm not a fan. So many people use it and they have such a reach. And now at least people who are using it are going to keep up with, if not beat, inflation. And so just the simple fact that a vast majority of Americans have their money in a savings account that's losing money to inflation. And now there's net, you know, so many amazing options to get 2-3%. Just on the money you have parked is really encouraging. I mean, that right there, I think each year Americans miss out on about $50 billion worth of interest by keeping their money parked in a low interest bearing savings account. So overall, I'm pretty optimistic, man. Even given the market shifts and changes on the consumer side, I think there's amazing education initiatives, strategies, tools, tactics that's making it easier for people to manage their money and learn how to do it. And at the end of the day, make money on their money, which is what obviously investing is all about.
Yeah. Well, Grant, thank you so much for joining us. And we appreciate your insight. Have a wonderful weekend. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jeff. You too.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah. 1, 1, 2, 2, bring it to the phone.
Welcome back, everyone, and now we're going to talk personal finance and retirement. And joining me is MarketWatch's personal finance and retirement reporter, Ms. Alessandro Melita. Let me do that again, Allie, because I blew your name. Sorry. Here we go. 3, 2, one. Welcome back, everyone. Now it's time for our personal finance segment. Joining me on the line is Ms. Alessandra Melito. She is the personal finance and retirement reporter for MarketWatch. Hey, Allie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I know you're out and about in New York City, but have a few minutes for us. You've got some great stories you did, and one of them is kind of near, you know, both of them are really pertinent for this end of year, but one of them really has to do with the holiday season.
Yeah. So I wrote a story about why grandparents should think twice before spoiling their kids and their grandkids this year. So somebody who has wonderful grandparents, I know that, you know, it's hard not to want to spoil the kids. Mm-hmm. Seniors have been racking up a lot of debt and filing for bankruptcy more than ever in recent years. They have higher rates of mortgage debt, of course, but a lot of seniors are also putting debt on their credit cards. Mm. So they're trying to pay for basic expenses and medical expenses, which obviously rise every year, especially as you get older. It's hard on grandparents. And I know that they probably insist on getting a lot of gifts or paying for college and all that kind of stuff. But maybe they should just go over the budget a few more times so that they're not putting expenses on credit cards that they don't actually have to spend.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And especially, as you alluded to, people have other expenses, healthcare, and other things that they need to pay for. And, you know, it's the thought that counts, and maybe it's the, you know, it's a small little gift card or it's a nice card. I know with my family, we kind of gave up exchanging gifts a long time ago, and now we just give each other cards and we shake each other's hands and give each other hugs, and that seems to do the trick. Although I have been told by my wife I need to find something for her this week for the holidays. So, that makes a lot of sense, and I think people just need to be prudent, as you're always talking about in your pieces.
Yes, definitely. Just, be honest. If you are finding yourself that you are risking putting yourself in credit card debt, especially with so many other expenses going on for, like, houses and medication and things like that, just be honest and say, like, I need to fall back or, you know, can we do something a little less expensive this year?
Well, that makes sense, and I hope all the grandparents and parents out there are listening and take that to heart. And now I know you want to talk about this, but I cannot believe we're at the year end, or almost at the year end, and it's going to be time to pay our federal and state taxes. And you came up with some tips to avoid an unpleasant tax surprise next year.
Yes. So in the beginning of the year, there was a report that came out saying that more taxpayers will owe the government more money than they expected next year because of the changes to the tax law. And if they didn't adjust their withholding, and if they're under withheld, they're obviously going to have to owe the government more money come tax time. So it's too late to do anything meaningful as far as like adjusting your allowances and stuff like that. But you can run some of the numbers and see how much you might owe if you're going to be under withheld and what disastrous number that might be. The IRS has a W-4 calculator that you could use. And if you plug in a few numbers, such as like what your wages are and how much you've already paid in taxes and things like that, you'll find out what your liability might be. So that's one thing that they can do. Mm-hmm. And also they can adjust their allowances this year. So if they realize that maybe what's not working out for them, they can adjust their allowances so that they start fresh in the new year and then maybe even get a refund the following year.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Another thing is, you know, figuring out if you're going to itemize or do the standard deduction. The standard deduction is a lot bigger than it was in years prior. It's $12,000 for single and $24,000 for married filing joint. But so that means a lot of people will not be itemizing, but it's still something to do. You should run the numbers for that because you could be losing potential savings there if you don't. For those who are 70 and a half and older, they should make sure that they're taking their required minimum distributions before the year end of the year, because otherwise they'll have a 50% penalty tax, and nobody wants that much money taken away.
No.
And then one other thing I will mention is just organizing your documents. I keep a binder with all of my paperwork, investment documents, all that kind of stuff, because it always pays to be organized. And also because the more organized you are, the better prepared you are, and that means you can file earlier. And what with all of these breaches constantly going on and retailers and even the government and stuff like that, it's better to file earlier to avoid somebody else filing for you and taking your refund if you do end up getting a refund. So
And let me ask you a question, Allie. Anything about obviously you know I got married this year, but anything about married people getting married, because this will be the first time that my wife and I will file either together or separately. Any thoughts about that that you were able to uncover?
Let's see. I should know that I'm engaged myself. I would say I'm not sure. I mean, as far as like the standard deduction going, what would it be, $24,000? If you do have the ability to itemize your deductions where you would go over that, maybe by like bunching charitable donations and things like that, that could really help, because, you know, that's a lot of money to deduct
sure.
from your taxes, from what you would owe. I have to think about that. I will be prepared for you next time.
Oh, no.
I will be sure.
And I didn't mean to put you on the spot, just so the audience knows. You know, we didn't talk about this offline, so I just kind of hit her with that, you know, and that's actually a little selfish on my part to ask you that question. But Allie, always
no.
a pleasure talking with you, and congratulations. I wasn't aware that you were engaged, so that's awesome.
Oh, yeah,
and, you know, the audience appreciates everything you and Jacob do, of course, and enjoy lunch with your friend, and have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up yet another edition of the Weekly Pulse podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you learned something today. Special thank you to Zach Tracer from Business Insider for his in-depth analysis on healthcare. And thank you again to you, the audience, for joining us. We look forward to having you back. Until then, have a great weekend.